the analogy of a boxer, an athlete, an elite athlete. And so we basically said, if being a Christian can be likened in some ways to being an athlete, how is it that people can become elite athletes with a very scientific training methodology? We pointed out last time that athletes running in the early 19th century wouldn't even be allowed on the track with athletes today. They wouldn't make it to qualifiers because science has allowed us to advance what the human machine can do. And if God created this machine, then understanding how this machine that we inhabit works might actually be something that can help us be better at obeying God. Now, the difference, and the one thing we'll say about this is, the reason that we want to obey God isn't that we think that that is what's going to save us. The reason we, in the same way that the reason a child wants to obey a parent isn't that if they don't, they won't be that parent's child anymore. So you are a child of God once you have entered into a relationship with Him. The question then is, how do you please God with what you do? Because we do see a lot of scripture about doing that. And we see that faith is kind of the basis of that. It's impossible to please God without faith. But it is possible, apparently, to please God in the faith that we have. Now, what is that faith? And now the question that was asked from the back table last time was, we had laid out a little bit of a case of what do we want to do when we're a Christian? If we're going to be a good Christian, what should be our goals in being a good Christian? And really the analogy would also be to be a good human. Maybe they're the same thing. So we had laid out up here, you might remember, there are kind of a couple of things that we all say we want. We do kind of want to be rich. We want to be prosperous in this world. But then we also recognize as Christians that this world is not the end, or Christians or Jews. That this world is not the end of it. There is another world past this. There is another life past this, or there's a continuation of life past this. So if that's true, then what should be our goal in this world? What should be our goal in the next world? And we did agree that deep down, self-interestedly, we all want to be happy. So today, we're going to look at two goals, the two goals that we ultimately have. In fact, I would like to make the argument here semi-conclusively if possible, that what all people want in all cultures, in all places in the world, if you boil it down, it boils down to only two things. They want to live forever, or alternately, they want to live as long as possible, and then they want to be as happy as possible for the whole time that they're alive. Now that sounds kind of simple, but ultimately, everything that we talk about, everything that we attempt as humans, is towards that goal. Does anybody know the country in the world that has the longest life expectancy? Japan, I hear. What else? Nepal. They're not terrible either. What else? Any other guesses?
Arkansas,
not a country, but due to the chicken fried steak, chicken fried
catfish.
Probably not. What else? Any other guesses?
There's a region in Russia where they live way past 100.
There are some enclaves where they seem to have some good genetics that work for them.
Yeah.
The right lifestyle. Monaco has the longest life expectancy. Now, Japan, yes. If you kind of take out the Monaco factor, which is what? Why do people in Monaco live longer than anybody else?
Money for doctors.
They pay to live longer. So the interesting thing is, if you have all the money in the world, when you're 20 years old, you spend it on something different. But once you start getting old, you spend it on preserving your own life. And we see that by taking the one of the highest per capita GDP countries in the world is also the longest living one. And the correlation there is their oncologists are some of the best in the world. They have access to some of the best in the world kind of thing. So when it gets down to it, you spend your treasure to buy more time. So that's a little bit of, that's one data point as a small argument towards what we do want to do is live long. Now look at the legends out there, the Sorcerer's Stone. You can live forever drinking the elixir of life. Ponce de Leon looking for the Fountain of Youth. We all want to kind of live forever. So we do, we like life. Life is precious to us. It's sweet to us, even though we complain about it. We say, you know, in the military, when your troops are complaining, they're actually happy. It's when they stop complaining and get quiet that you need to worry. Some of that's true of the human condition as well. But if those are the two, does anybody disagree with that? We want to be as happy as we can be. We want to live as long as we possibly can.
Grouch.
Say again?
Grouch. Sesame Street.
Oscar the Grouch, or like I want to be, you know, kids get off my lawn kind of thing when I get old. That still makes them happy, though, doesn't it? Because you get off my lawn, kids, and they walk away. It's like, yeah, that's right. So it's still a pursuit of happiness. Okay, so let's assume that that's the case. Let's assume it's the case that we want to be happy and that we want to live as long as we can. Why do I bring this up? Well, first, it's a test of religion. It's a test of religion. Every fairy tales point this out. By the way, what's the ending to every fairy tale? And they lived happily ever after. That is the ideal. That's what we want. If your religion doesn't give you those two things, what good is it? If your religion doesn't give the human being what he or she wants, what good is it? Now, I'm not saying that the purpose of religion is to please people, but if God cares, loves people, cares about people, then the orders that he gives people ought to do what? Make them live long and make them happy. What is the promise to the nation of Israel if they obey the law? Of course, I'm picking on my Jewish compadres here. What's the promise to Israel by God if they obey the law?
That they'll live healthy, they won't have sickness, they'll live long lives, etc.
And they'll live prosperously in the land by all of these things. This is what God wants for people in general. Now, because we know that, is that a promise that you will prosper in this life? Well, to the Jew who obeys the law under that covenant, it is. God doesn't get to make promise one thing and then not deliver on it. So when the Jewish nation was doing that, you'll notice that that's the way things went. And so that promise is there. Now, what about us Gentiles? Now, you can look at Paul saying, well, not all Israel is Israel, and we are now the new Israel, etc., or because we follow the Messiah, that's the remnant of Israel, that's the true Israel. But at the end of the day, what we recognize about the Christian religion is whether it's in this life or the next life, it's life forever, and it's joy, it's happiness, it's all the fruits of the Spirit, which are love, joy, peace, patience, all those kinds of things. Christianity, Judaism, look at a God who says, I am going to give you eternal life and eternal joy. Those are the deepest things that human beings want. If there's a religion out there that doesn't do that for you, to me, it's a sign that God is not at the back of it. Or if he is at the back of it, this is the diabolical part. If he is at the back of it, then what? What's the conclusion?
That he's not a good God.
Doesn't want you best. Yeah, he's got another agenda other than the happiness of his creatures. Now, why doesn't that work? Why does a Christian automatically reject that out of hand?
God's good.
Not our concept of God, right? Our understanding of who God is from the scriptures and from philosophy and all the other things are that he is a good God who is interested in the happiness of his creatures. Now, what's in a quick aside, just so that I'm not losing anybody here, what is the best way to be happy according to the scriptures?
Follow God's laws.
Right. So there's going to be, you'll see how we'll tie this stuff in together. But at the end of the day, I'm not preaching some version of a prosperity gospel here. That's not what I'm after. What I'm after is, what can we do with science to make us pursue the goals of our religion when the goals of our religion actually seem to end, at least partway, in our own happiness and the fulfillment of what we actually want? So when I look at things like Buddhism as an example, what's the ultimate goal of Buddhism?
To eliminate desire.
To eliminate desire to such a degree that you yourself what?
You're self-fulfilled, so that your happiness comes from within and you're not defined by external.
Now, that will lead you to enlightenment, and enlightenment will lead, eventually takes you to what's the final state of Buddhism?
Nirvana.
Nirvana, and what is nirvana?
Nothing.
Nothingness. Now, what's the problem with the concept of achieving nothingness? Nobody wants it. Nobody wants it. You don't want, if we're true about what we say in our hearts, we don't want to become nothing. We want to become and we want to become happy.
On that, though, there's a whole other world on the other side of that nothingness, though.
There are worlds on the way there that will take you. You can become a god, you can become other things, but at the end of the day, even the gods get reincarnated because they're not there yet. It's only when you pass entirely past that world into the realization that this is nothing that you hit the final end. But you're right, there are other layers out there.
We're getting into transcendental meditation and that type of thing. When we start getting into nirvana, and I'm not going to take you there, but I am from California.
Fair enough, right? So you do have your local subject matter expert.
So then why is there such an appeal for Buddhism? Like, if it's not something that's going to fulfill people, if people recognize the end goal of Buddhism is to achieve this state of nothingness, then why would people follow it?
I will follow up your question with another question. Most, 90% plus will agree, of Americans are following the American dream. What's the American dream?
Chicken in every pot.
Chicken in every pot, right?
Consumption.
Consumption. And if you ask an American, the same American who said, if you say, why are you going to work? I'm going to work so I can have a good future for my kid. What does a good future for your kid look like? They can get educated so they can lead a successful career. Why is that? So they can be prosperous. What do you mean prosperous? So they basically can be rich or richer than average? Yeah, that's ultimately what my goal is for my kid. But do riches make people happy? And they'll tell you that. And then you ask them the question, why are you pursuing the American dream if you know at the outset the American dream doesn't make you happy? The answer to that question is identical to the answer of why do people follow Buddhism. At the end of the day, your culture tells you to do it. The people around you encourage you to do it. And if you don't sit and think about it yourself, you don't do your own ideas. You follow other people's ideas.
But I think Buddhism also taps into, you know, when people begin a spiritual walk, they realize that they have bad desires. And so Buddhism is attractive because it says this will help you eliminate these bad desires, that you have at least spiritually awoken to the fact that these desires lead you down bad paths in life. And I think that's the attraction of Buddhism.
That's part of the attraction, and the attraction to any religion is usually the truth in the religion. And that is true about Buddhism. Buddhism has that right. If you can get rid of desires, and what they say all desires, but in reality we know what desires we want to get rid of. Evil desires. We don't want to get rid of good desires. Right? Now, part of the thing that makes me not happy about Buddhism is Gautama Buddha walked away from his son because he called him basically the ball and chain that was still holding him to this earth. So we look at that and we're like, I don't know if that's a good thing. I understand what he was after, but at the end of the day, Buddhism is right by saying you need to rid yourself of desires, but it's wrong by saying all desires. Because there are right desires and there are wrong desires. And we made the argument last time of if you follow right desires, it gives you something that can't be taken away from you. I use the analogy of you look back in your life and nobody's like, oh, I remember the day that I bought the iPhone 4S. That was a joy that lasted forever. But you do turn around and say, I do remember the day when I reached out and helped this person who couldn't help themselves and it really benefited them. And that stays in your heart as an internal reward that never dissipates. And to me, that is an empirical test, a one data point or two data points of, it's kind of a touchstone of this does not bring long-lasting joy and this does bring long-lasting joy. Peter did this.
I think if I were to try Buddhism, the first desire I would try and rid myself of is the one to reach nothingness.
Right. Peter is our jujitsu man when it comes to logic. Okay, Dennis.
One of your messages that a desire for riches is a bad desire?
No, I don't think so. I think God put the desire for wealth in man's heart. And I think that he tries to fulfill that one. In fact, what is Jesus' number one motivation that he tells his disciples on the earth?
Life abundantly.
So he's hit point one, right? What's the other? What does he encourage people to do about material stuff?
Get it.
Store up treasure in heaven.
Store up treasure in heaven. It's interesting that Jesus motivates us by the desire for gain. Jesus motivates us by desire for gain. Sell all you have, give it to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven. Come and follow me. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who, a trader, who finds a pearl of great price, and he sells all that he has to buy that pearl. And again, the kingdom of heaven is like a man who finds a treasure in a field, and he sells all that he has and buys the field so that he can have what? The greater treasure that he found in the field. The kingdom of God is not about being poor. The kingdom of God is about being rich. It's just a different kind of riches, generally speaking, than the ones that we are motivated by in this world. Because what does Jesus say about the riches of this world? Do not store up for yourselves treasure in this world where thieves where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal, but instead treasure, store up for yourself treasure which is in heaven. So the, Dennis, you're right, our goal is gain.
But it sounds almost like you're saying that getting riches in this world, like being wealthy in this world, is not a good thing.
Not that it's not a good thing, but if it distracts you from that other thing, that is, put it this way, you got $100 in your pocket, or I'll give an example of a Marine that I had. This is one of my favorite stories because it defies a lot of logic. This Marine was a guy who was a young Marine, saved up every penny he had. He ate at the chow hall. The only place that he worked out was, you know, on the base because they didn't do anything but Marine around as a young Marine. The guy was a special fellow. He was a very Marine. So he saves up over time, $10,000 by the time he's like an E3 or something. And his dad tells him, I want you to invest this $10,000 in this set of stocks. And he does. And they go bust and he loses basically all of it. So he saves up another $10,000 by the same way of doing business. And he buys some penny stock at something like 3 cents a share. And he's out in Okinawa now as a gunnery sergeant. And I'm a first lieutenant out in Okinawa. And he says, hey, sir. And he was an interesting guy. His mouth hangs open every time he's done talking. He says, hey, sir.
Yeah.
We call him Strike. Strike was his nickname.
You already said he was a Marine.
He's a Marine. Yeah. So he says, hey, sir, could you come over here and tell me if I'm doing this math right? Because he'd be the first to tell you, numbers confuse me, I don't like them, you can help me out with this. And to give you an idea of his personality, we heard him on the phone talking. His mom, his wife, was having trouble with the six-year-old boy at home. So she's called dad, so the dad can give him the, you're the man at home when I'm away speech. And we're listening to him give the standard speech, we're like, yeah. And he's like, now, I mean, what happens if I go off to war and get my head chopped off? Who's going to be in charge of the family? We're gunny. You cannot tell a six-year-old kid. So, the guy's father was all Marine, but this was the level of sophistication which he operated. And so he's got his, contrary to the what you're allowed to do on a Marine Corps base, on an official computer, he's got his personal investment webpage up. He's only got one, because he only got one stock. He's got 10,000 shares of it. And he's like, am I right? Do I have $450,000? And I'm like, no, Gunny, you're not doing the math right. You're off by a zero. You have $4.5 million in this account. Well, he bought AOL.
What was the stock?
AOL. And this was the time he was at his peak. He bought AOL at pennies per share when it was first came out.
Did he sell it?
I said, I'm no longer Lieutenant Tomlinson. Let me give you a little advice. This is what you're going to do. You're going to sell it. You're going to put this much in taxes. You'll have about $2.6 million at the end of it. What do you want in life? And Gunny, after a 10-minute conversation, this is what Gunny wanted in life. Two things. Three things. One, a motorhome. So he can travel around and see all 50 states with his kids. Two, he wanted to send his kids to good schools. I'm like, great, you can send them any school you want. What's your kid's good at anything? My daughter likes to play the piano. You could send her to Juilliard if you wanted to. He's like, what's Juilliard? I'm like, never mind. And the third thing he wanted was to be a sergeant major.
You're what?
Sergeant major of Marines. And you can't buy that, right? So I'm like, Gunny, you're going to be a happy man. And Gunny is going to be happy because what he wanted fits within what he has been given by a lot. By less now, because he didn't listen to my advice and sell it, but I'm sure he's still doing fine. So, why do I bring that up? A, it's an entertaining story, but B, if you take your $10,000 and you do what most Marines do, well, let's say you do what the slightly wiser Marine does.
It's family-oriented class.
Yeah, family class. you do what some Marines do, which is you go out and you buy a car that you can now buy so you can impress the girls. You buy, maybe you even save up a little money so that you can buy something, you know, a little bit of property on your own that you can build a house on, or you can buy an apartment or something like that. Some Marines instead forego the short-term, smaller gain in order to invest to be a gunnery sergeant with $4 million. Now, obviously that came with a lot of luck in the stock market, but everybody's seen the Dave Ramsey classes, I'm sure, that if you start saving when you're y'all's age, by the time that you hit your dad's age, you're going to have $1 million in the bank because of the way compound interest works and all that kind of stuff. So it is foregoing short-term gain for the long-term gain that doesn't go away. Because everybody hears about the 1% in America. Do you know why the 1% are the 1%?
Because they started as the 1%.
Because they start as the 1%. Once you make a certain amount of money and you are careful about how you spend it and you only spend some percentage of it, that money never leaves. So But the, you make $80,000 a year, you spend $80,000 a year. Their money is worth $100 million, and the interest alone, they may be able to expense, let's say, $10 million of that, and still put another $2 million to increase that $100 million, now it's $102 million, that kind of thing. So over time, if you have enough money, it does make money. Now, I'm not saying this is not a class on how to be wealthy, but the idea is, if you're willing to forego short-term gain, you can have long-term gain that is longer lasting. Godly gain never leaves, always increases. Godly gain is not gold and silver. Godly gain is family. Godly gain, and I'm getting ahead of myself, I'm just giving you some examples. At the end of the day, if you are, and we said this last time, if you are in your vault caressing the bars of gold you have, when you're 80 years old, that doesn't do you any good. But if you're in your house, surrounded by your children and grandchildren, doesn't that increase the joy in your heart? I mean, you've got probably the most kids of anybody in here. How much money would it cost for you to sell one of your kids? How much would I have to give you? But at the end of the day, even if I laid $1 billion on the table, they would not sell a child for $1 billion. I said, I'll never see him again. You know, that's it. I'm cut off.
I got five. They're all
the same. All the same.
One thing, there was a guy who won the Monster Lottery some years ago. They won some swamp parish in Louisiana. How did you count to 10? But he won. First thing he did was told the wife to hit the road. He spent it all in like a year. And people said to him, you idiots. He wound up a drunk, broker than he was before. He said, dude, I got a lifetime of memories.
He does. Now the question is, in 10 years, will he wish he had done something different? And if the answer is no, then you're right. He's not very smart enough.
So are you using the science of economics to help give some parallel demonstration to building up some treasure in God?
A little bit, because the decision that Jesus is asking us to make isn't forego your desires entirely. The decision he's saying is your desire for happiness, because ultimately, why do we think money is good? Money in itself has no value. This is a gold atom. What good is it to you? Here's a pile of gold atoms. What good are they to you? Nothing. The idea is they represent something. They represent the ability to hand this gold to somebody
else. Well, that's definitely give us an answer.
Right. So ultimately what I'm saying is people equate money and happiness. And when Jesus is talking to people, when God's talking to people, he's saying, well, I know you want to be happy. You're pursuing riches because they're a means to happiness. But we all know deep down that riches don't bring you happiness of a certain type. And what I'm trying to do is contrast two types of wealth, which economics doesn't do. Economics calls wealth one thing, and it assumes that the instrument of trade, whether it's goods, services, or money, some sort of monetary instrument, are what all people want. That's why economics fails to make us totally happy, because it doesn't differentiate between good wealth and bad wealth. And good wealth is the stuff that never leaves you. So I'm a little ahead of myself, but let me make a quick argument for wealth doesn't make you happy. And I'll send you these links after class. There are two. So I promised science, and this is the science that we're going to start with right here. The Grant study is a 75-year dual cohort, single cohort study. There's another cohort that was brought in as well. That studied Harvard grads, all white males, for 75 years. It was the longest longitudinal running study on kind of human happiness and economics that we have today. Somebody at some point pointed out to the folks that were running the study, hey, great subject pool, rich white guys from Harvard. And they were like, okay, all right, good point. So they made another cohort of disadvantaged white males so that they could compare white males to white males. From disadvantaged portions of the neighborhood, but not people who had significant criminal record, that kind of stuff. So there was basically a socioeconomic adjustment in there. The Grant study concluded, and I think I've said this in this class before, but this will give you some more specificity eventually. The Grant study concluded with five words, according to the director of the study, and I'll send you a link to the book that kind of summarizes it all. Happiness equals love, full stop, or happiness equals love. So if happiness equals love, that's the scientific, economic view of what makes people happy. These are the Harvard elite In the cohort were congressmen, senators. JFK was one of the people who was in the group. So these were not people who didn't have the ability or didn't end up making money in the long run. So if money will make you happy, the study should have shown it because of the people that were involved. What the study showed instead was that your relationship with your mother, your relationship with your father, and how you would characterize a relationship with people that are close to you was the most significant contributing factor to your personal happiness, self-reported, and as they could tease out from the study. The other studies like that show very similar results. But at the end of the day, science will tell you that love is the key to happiness. If love is the key to happiness, which of the religions puts the most premium on love? What's the greatest commandment in Christianity? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, and all your strength. And Judaism, of course, borrowed straight from Moses there. And love your neighbor as yourself is the second one. So the other thing, the other reason I like Christianity as a religion, other than the fact that it seems to me to be true, provably true, is not only does it recognize what you want, happiness and long life, and it promises both of those, it also seems to know what makes you happy. People look at Christianity and Judaism as a set of rules. In Judaism, it's 600, is it 600? I keep saying 613. How many mitzvot? Is that right? Right on one thing. There's a first one. 613 laws. And everybody's like, these laws are, I can either live by these laws or I can go be free and happy. The purpose of all of those laws is to maximize your happiness. It is no different than reading the instruction manual, as I've said before, of a vehicle like a Ferrari. Those instructions aren't there to make you less happy with your Ferrari. I got to put oil in it. Bunch of jerks. No. The purpose of the orders are the people that built the Ferrari know how to make you the happiest with it. So listen to them. If God's the one that built your Ferrari, this machine that your mind steers around, then you ought to listen to him because he knows how to make it happy. And he knows that love is the thing that does it. And so his number one and his number two command, in fact, he says all along the prophets hang on it, are to love God and love other people. Just a point to point out to you guys, a little bit of an argument for a little bit of data suggesting the Judeo-Christian worldview is one that recognizes all these things that science tells us today in the best studies that we have are true. This is matching scientific data and data that we already have from Scripture. So there's also something that the UN does, and I'm going to pull up so I can read from a little portion of it. Something the UN does called the World Happiness Report. Nepal is the only country, we mentioned Nepal, I forget it. Nepal is the only country who has gone from GDP, gross domestic product, as an indicator of growth to what? Anybody know what Nepal's measure is?
Happiness index.
GHP, gross happiness index, maybe GHI. So Nepal, good on them, Buddhists are leading the way here a little bit, have recognized something that we have not yet recognized. The key to happiness is not domestic product. It's not money. The key to happiness, now, some of that is contradicted in here a little bit, so it actually turns out to be a little bit of both, because what this data will tell you from reports like these are if you are below a certain level of income, basically kind of a poverty line, your happiness tends to suffer as a result, because you are worried about where your next meal comes from, etc. Now, is there a religion, though, that mitigates that? Let's say you're dirt poor and you don't know where your next meal is coming from. What religion, there are several, but what does Christianity tell you about that? You better remember? Do not say to yourself, what shall we eat or what shall we wear? Look at the lilies of the field. They neither spin nor sow. And I tell you that Solomon in all his glory was not clothed as these. And look at the sparrows of the air. Not a single one of them falls from the sky, but your heavenly Father knows. Are you not worth more than one sparrow? Two of them are sold for a penny. Are you not worth more than one sparrow? God tells you, even when you're poor, you don't have to worry because you have me to depend upon. All right, that's interesting. And if you haven't read some of the books, like George Mueller, who has got some great stories, read about him, ran an orphanage, I think in England, if anybody knows, correct me if that's wrong. But he literally is like, God, we're out of bread, we need food. And next thing you know, somebody dropped off three sacks of flour for them to mill overnight. Someone led them to do that. That's how that life actually works out in the long run. So, give me a second. I pulled up the wrong page here. World Happiness Report. They measured This is interesting. So there's two reports. The second report delved deeper into issues relating, I'm reading from Wikipedia's page on this one, of course, relating to happiness, including mental illness, the objective benefits of happiness, importance of ethics, etc., etc. I'm reading from the wrong place in Wikipedia.
Don't do that.
As always. All right, well, I'll have to look at, I'm sorry, I pulled the wrong page. Ultimately, the stuff that, when you look up the report, when you see what are the indicators, what they call subjective well-being, those indicators turn out to match the exact same things that are indicators in the Judeo-Christian worldview. Relationships with other people, contentment, freedom. Remember that the goal of the law and the goal of God's commands is not to make you a slave. It's to set you free. Set you free from what? What are we saying in Christianity? What are we set free from as Christians?
Sin.
What is sin? What would you call sin? Don't we say it's a desire to do something that is wrong?
Vocabulary word.
It is. It is disobedience to God. We want to be set free from disobedience to God, right? But what is it that stands in the way of being set free from disobedience to God? Is it not our own desire for those things, for that thing? So interestingly, freedom in Christianity is freedom from a desire or set of desires. So that's something key, and this is why now when I look at Buddhism and I look at Christianity, I say the difference between Buddhism and Christianity is Buddhism seeks to set you free from all desire. Christianity seeks to set you free from bad desire, because I think intuitively we know the difference. Okay. So I wanted to put those two scientific data points out there and point out that, oh, by the way, the happiness index, the happiest country in the world is? Anybody know?
Norway.
Not in the world.
Because Norway, Finland, one of them up there.
Yeah, Switzerland edged them out, but it's all these Scandinavian countries, which means that the secret of happiness is?
Socialism.
Being tall and being blonde. Or socialism, right? No, the secret of happiness has to do with those things that they have. Freedom from corruption, freedom from like despotism, not ongoing war. The contentment thing is easy because they don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, that kind of thing, generally speaking. So, and then at the bottom of the list, you'll see everybody that you would predict to be on the bottom of the list kind of thing. Japan, interestingly, a very rich country, is 43rd on the list. We are 13th on the list. The United States, I think, is 13th or 14th on the list. So it is of note that there are some correlations there. I'm not saying that Swiss people are better Christians. What I'm saying is they've hit on some of the keys of what Americans haven't figured out yet. And I'll get to you two in 1 second, sorry. The Swiss are often criticized by Americans, specifically capitalists, who say, why would we want, like the Europeans, to live these unimportant, impactless lives? And they mean it from a advancement perspective of does society advance? Well, like the Amish, who Dennis brought up last time and asked a good question about the Amish, they have figured out that the secret to happiness isn't progress. The secret to happiness isn't increased gain. The secret to happiness isn't a growing GDP. That there's some bound they're putting on contentment and they're going after it. Christianity does the same thing. And I'll tell you why Christianity is better than Switzerland. For a multitude of reasons. But one of them is, Christianity maximizes that minimum bit that's going to make you happy. Because wouldn't a good goal be saying, how many things does it take to make me happy? Well, if I have to have a great family life, and I have to have a bunch of money, and I have to have, you know, a great job that's rewarding to me, and I have to have, and let the list go on, you've got to have 5 or 6 things in order to be happy. When one of those fails, what happens? If you're Swiss and you lose your job, you're less happy, right? What if you can fail all that back down to say this? And then we know this from the fairy tales as well. Or the short story. Did anybody have to read that terrible, terrible short story about the guy, the poor, newly married couple? She has long, beautiful hair. That's the only treasure she has. You know this one? You heard this one?
I love this.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story. And the only thing that he has is this beautiful watch that his dad gave. And for Christmas, they gave each other gifts. He sells his watch, the dearest thing that he has, in order to buy a set of jeweled combs for her to put in her hair. Because he knows the treasure she has and he looks to increase it. She cuts her hair off and sells it to buy him a chain, I think, to hang the watch. Okay. And you know, it's kind of sad initially because you're like, oh, they both missed a point, they both lost their treasure. But what's the actual purpose of the story? They showed the treasure that they really had, which is the love for each other.
For once, something comes out of your mouth that's really cool. That's a cool story.
There you go. All right. Let that be the one thing that I was
print that out to do with that.
Unfortunately, not my story. Some other guy.
You remember who the author was?
I don't, but
Gift of the Magi.
Gift of the Magi was the name of the short story.
Oh, Gift of the Magi.
So, and why the Magi? Who were the Magi?
Three kings.
The three kings, and we also call them?
Wise men.
The three wise men. And the implication here is they are wise because they recognize what the one thing is of value of love. If the thing that you need to be happy really is love, who can take love away from you? It can't be done. It can't be done. You can never lose love. Even if they take the object of your love and they send them and they put them in prison or they kill them, you can still have that love and regard for the other person. And in Judaism and Christianity, what's the advantage? Did you lose them? For a span, you will see them again. And you can see, again, another data point of why Christianity makes sense in the pursuit of things that we want.
You mentioned a while ago that one of the Scandinavian countries is the happiest country or...
Yeah, Switzerland was, Norway, Sweden all do well in the...
Doesn't Sweden lead the world in suicide rate also?
I don't know, but if it is, if it does, it's the people that are bringing down the average. So guys that are 7, interestingly, it's done on a scale of 1 to 10. The happiest country in the world averages what? Do you think? On a scale of 1 to 10, what's the average citizen's happiness?
5.
That's
the
high.
7.
7.5. 7.6, maybe. 7.6. The least happy in the UN, I think it's a UN survey, maybe only. The least happy people are at what level? 5. I'm kind of happy, I'm not whatever, kind of in the middle. The difference between being the greatest country in the world and the least happy country in the world, it's not like an act of war where everybody's getting killed around you, is 2.5 points on a 10-point scale. 7.5. How happy are you? On a scale of 1 to 10, is anybody in here happier than a 7.5? Raise your hand. So an atheist is, good. What else? Now what I will say is this, although Dennis may have a good point, on average, you will find that people who claim to be religious but have an advanced level of belief that says it's not just a name for them, almost always score higher on happiness. Now that might be, there are a whole bunch of reasons that might be, but one of the reasons you should consider is it might be that this system, which is a God-designed system, is the best at making you happy. Is the best at making you happy. I look at the Amish or the Orthodox Jews as an example to say, most people say, I don't want to have to dress with special hats, and I can't use a razor on the side of my head, and I have to follow all these things, or I don't want to have to drive a horse cart and harvest my grain without the advantages of a tractor, you know, all this kind of stuff. Yet they are generally happier than the average people are. Why is that? Is the secret to happiness foregoing the diesel engine? Is the secret to happiness hats that haven't changed in millennia? I don't think so. And they would tell you the same thing. Why do you think that works? Why do you guys think the system works like that? Why does following rules make you happier than people who claim to be more free than you are? Putting you on the spot. You don't have to answer.
What do you think?
Well, all of you. I'm sitting back. Yeah, so, if you don't want to answer, you don't have to, but interject if you do. Most people will say, who are in both those sets of religion, I know what it takes to be content, and what it takes to be, my goals are not your goals. And while they won't say it this way, they will think in their head, and we think in our head, our goals are higher. And for that reason, when we even go partially on the way to achieving them, we are happier.
You had those young Marines who want, I hate this place, I can't wait to get out,
yes.
All these stupid rules, I'm getting out. And you had the discussion, think about this, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
What percentage of those people that left came back and talked to you and said, I miss it, things are hard out here, and you see that having that structure and that set of rules and having a well-defined role within a system, whether it be, you know, Christianity or military structure or anything, having that sense of purpose and structure gives a lot of people a lot of happiness.
Perfect bridge. Skyler does this all the time. I have not paid him to do this. This question was not a plan. Yes, the Marine, most of them, can answer your question. When the Marine comes back and says, I miss it, what he is also doing, and some of them will state this and some of them won't, will say, he's saying this, or she's saying this, I was proud of who I was in the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps, or the Army, the Air Force, Navy, made me a better man or woman. And that is something that makes me proud. But you have, what we usually don't get into, some most Marine officers don't, is why does that make you proud? And then they'll go through the list. And you say, are those virtues or those vices? And the bottom line is, well, the Marine Corps system is not a perfect system, far from it. But it at least is focused on building what it thinks is a virtuous person. Now, it misses virtue a little bit. It is a bit of an extremist organization, I can say, as an extremist in there. So its idea of a virtuous, the virtuous ideal differs in the Marine Corps than it does elsewhere. As a result, it's my belief that's why being a Marine isn't the thing that will make you the happiest in the world. The person whose virtue list actually matches the ideals that really are, the real actual virtues, that's the one you want to shoot for. And although Marines might be people to whom some might aspire, not everybody in the world is like, well, if one is a good Marine, then one is a good man. Not necessarily. Because of the set of goals. And he used my favorite word, purpose. Purpose. So the problem, the Marine Corps sort of recognizes this. Okay, the purpose of every Marine is to be a
rifleman,
right? Every Marine's a rifleman, so they've got kind of a common purpose. But if you're a logistician, that's not really your only purpose, right? You're doing logistics a lot as well. So they have kind of sub-purposes that fit in there. This is a little bit analogous to Christianity, to Judaism. The purpose is to be someone who lives and enjoys God, knows and understands God and enjoys Him, and has that love relationship. But like Asher pointed out a couple months ago, not everybody's purpose is the same. He's not from the tribe of Levi, so even if he wants to be a priest, he can't be a priest, because he's not one of the Kohanim. He's not one of the people who are marked from birth, whose purpose is to be a priest. So his purpose, God must have made him for something else. And the same is true of all of you. Sometimes we look at Mike Minter and say, wow, that guy's terrific. He's very down to earth. He can look at a biblical passage that I've gone over 10 times myself, and he expounds all this wisdom out of it. I really wish I could do that. Okay, hop on up on stage. Well, wait a second. Wait, I don't really want to do that. Wait, you said that what you're doing is, what's why? Why do you not want to be on stage, but you say, I wish I could be like Mike Minter? What are you really saying, do you think?
I think you're saying, man.
Yes or no? Fire away.
I admire Mike.
I think that's it. In a line, it's this. We admire when somebody, and this, we don't state this because we've forgotten this. We admire when somebody is fulfilling their purpose, and it's obvious. When you fulfill your purpose, that's what it looks like. Now, that's a public example of what it looks like. There are much smaller examples of what it looks like. I'll give you an example that I think is terrific. Lisa Scholl, one of the least recognized people in this church, an absolute foundation stone in this church. Bob Scholl's wife, mother of nine. One of the secrets to why this youth group works so well here is because Bob had an inside track of leaders that he bred. And they, because of their spacing, were he had a staff that he owned, lock, stock, and barrel. And then he had a support system that worked really well. His wife is a saint. And her support, nothing of what happens in that would have worked without Lisa doing what she did. None of the character of those kids, as good as their dad was at leading them, would have worked out if they didn't have mom's support doing what she did. Don't believe me? Go read the Grant study. Because what you'll find out is mama is more important than dad to happiness for white males that are very rich. Mama wasn't more important than dad was. Dad was most important towards the end of your life when you said, am I satisfied with my life? Your relationship with your dad actually had the most to do with that. But go back and read the Grant study, and it's short. Some of the conclusions of it are short, and see what some of those keys to happiness were. Lisa Scholl is a great example of a lady living her purpose, and then one time I pulled her off to the side and said, I need to sit down with you and find out what you did, because the family that you have had, the support you have provided, I know nobody recognizes it, but I think it's the most powerful testimony I've seen here at RBC. And she starts crying. And I'm like, good, I said something right. Or I said something really wrong, because it turns out it was right. But people like that don't get recognized. And that is, I think, part of the real part of he who is first will be last, and he who is last will be first. Lisa will be walking through the gates of heaven before I will. I guarantee you that. And it'll be interesting to see what God's purpose for her is in the long run.
I think this also gets at the heart of what Christopher Hitchens got so wrong. You know, he said, I don't want to be beholden to a divine North Korea. I have no desire to submit my will to God. And what he never intellectually realized is by rejecting God, he's submitting himself to the laws of this world. And he intellectually, without even understanding it, said the values of the world, intellectual freedom is more important to me than anything else, not realizing that that is valueless without a higher purpose.
And you're absolutely right. And let's decode that a little bit too as well. What is, we talk about the laws of the world or the values of the world. What does that actually mean? What we mean is this. The world tells you, why do you dress like you do? Are these optimal clothes? No, the Air Force already built it. It's a flight suit, right? these are not optimal clothes. This is not, this doesn't even make sense. It's a pain to put on. It's too hot in the summer. It's too cold in the winter, you know.
That's why I have one like that. It hangs my clothes.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the shoes, are they more comfortable? You know, this is not optimal. This is what the society tells us to do. And if you go back to the history of fashion, for those who've seen The Devil Wears Prada, when the one girl is talking about why is this important, the lady's like, everything that you're wearing comes from colors and fashion stuff that was designed and put in purpose. Now, that sounds like I'm trying to make fashion important. You know what the real lesson was that they didn't state in there is? What a completely random and subjective standard that is set by a few people who live in New York, Milan, Paris, etc. And we do what they want. And I'm not kind of being matrix and be like, this is a system of control. What if I were to tell you? No, just kidding. So the idea is it is a system of control. The reason the matrix makes sense to us is because we do intuitively feel what Morpheus said in there. Hasn't there always been a splinter in your mind that tells you something's wrong with the world? Now, in his interpretation, it was because the world was a fake world and the machines were running us. Who's the analogy of the machines in Christianity, in Judaism? The devil and his forces. So if there really are dark forces at work, and they do have a system, then we got to recognize who's telling us what to dress as, and who's telling us what to watch on TV. Now, let's say there's not devils and demons out there. The question still is out there. And who are the people that we say do that when we really want to be conspiratorially minded?
The Illuminati.
The Illuminati, 33rd Degree Masons, the Skull and Bones Club, all these folks who are secretly running the world. It's the Pentagon, the Gettys, the Rothschilds, and Colonel Sanders. So if you look at human beings' belief system worldwide, and if you want conspiracy theory, go to the Middle East. There's a conspiracy there for everything. I will hit you then. Sorry, I apologize. If you're looking at the conspiracy theory mindset, you ask the question, is there any truth to that? Well, 99% of those conspiracies are nonsense. But there are actual people behind ideas. That's where ideas come from. So the question is, where are the ideas coming from, and who's sourcing them, and how true are they? Because people come up with good and true ideas as well. So I just ask you to ask those questions. When you're considering your own happiness, your own pursuit of happiness, if it has to do with clothes, you should consider who's telling you those clothes will make you happy. If it has to do with money, you should consider who's telling you that.
Well, I want to take issue with what Carl just said. Like him, I rejected the celestial world 3 years ago, and I'm a lot happier. You know, you can take this for what it's worth. You can call it self-serving, but I'm a lot happier now than I was when I was a Christian. And to me, it was rejecting this idea of this guy sitting up and you do this, or this.
Now there is, and also
Hitchens being off base with.
What was the point?
What Dennis was saying was, he, like Christopher Hitchens, had rejected, was happier once he rejected Christianity, because Christianity was a system of rules, or was an authority sitting there telling you to do stuff that you didn't necessarily want to do, and that you would be happier if you didn't do.
It's not quite that simple, but it's...
Well, it's something similar to that, right?
Yeah.
So that, and by the way, that viewpoint is supported in some ways by the research. One of the six factors the UN determined was contributory to the happiness level of people was freedom. Freedom from laws that were not laws they wanted to find, and freedom from corruption was the other part. So I think Dennis's point is with your permission, I'll say half right. You do want to be free of despotism. You want to be free of dictatorship. You want to be free because why is a dictator bad? Why is a dictator bad?
Makes you conform, takes your freedom away.
For what purpose?
For his own.
To enrich himself.
Yeah.
So if the dictator, is there any, and Mark Twain has said, by the way, in the Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, he says the best system of government, basically, I'm paraphrasing, is a benevolent dictatorship. But they never work out, because even if you do manage to get one, he's handing it off to the next knucklehead, his son or something, and that guy messes it all up. So at the end of the day, he's for democracy, and that's why, because it prevents that happening. What if you had an eternal good dictator? What if, and it, based on Dennis's description, let's generalize it. There are churches that you can walk into from where I am, was from, in Georgia and in Tennessee, where when you walk in, or let's take the worst, the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah.
Okay, the Westboro Baptist Church, you walk in there, you're going to get a sense of following rules that don't in any way seem to be linked towards making you happy.
What church is this?
These are the people that do the horrible protesting stuff. Veterans.
What'd you call it?
Westboro Baptist Church.
They're unfortunately in Westboro. They're unfortunately notorious as just horrible, horrible people. If you Google Westboro Baptist, I wouldn't even do that. They're terrible people. So the idea, though, is if there is a benevolent dictator that knows everything about you and is interested in your happiness most, there would be no better set of rules to follow. Because riddle me this, who here lives without rules entirely?
Nobody.
Anywhere in the world. Nobody does. Even if the reason you throw out these other rules is so that you can follow these rules.
Yeah.
And who's making these rules up? Sometimes we'll say we're making the rules up ourselves. But I would ask Mr. Hitchens, who made up the rules you're following? You think you did? You did not. You were told those rules by somebody else.
They evolved.
Or you can say they evolved. But if they evolved, remember the whole idea is under evolution, all societal rules come from where? Social contract. Whether it's a sophisticated society like ours or whether it's a group of people in the jungle, it's all social contract. So you're making up the rules as you go. So we've had that discussion too. So
yeah, it's always by consensus.
And it's by consensus. And then the downside of that we've talked about is what if the consensus is National Socialism in Germany in 1939. Does that make it right? So now we ask the question, what we wanted to do today, and we'll kind of wrap it up and take some last comments here. What we wanted to do today was make the following argument. Happiness and long life are the keys to what humans ultimately desire that is good. Christianity, Judeo-Christian values and system, match that. What is it that makes us happy? Love is what makes us happy. Not love for money, love for people. Love for other people, and I'll say God is a person in this sense. Love is what makes us the most happy. Which religion says that's the case, makes it its foremost command? Christianity. We're now kind of two for two. When we look at the science and we say, does the science say both of these things? Yes. What else does science say about when you study religious people? Religious people tend to be happier. Here's some other confirmation that system that's outlined, in fact, works from a scientific perspective. So the question today that we wanted to answer, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty next time, is what are the goals for the Christian? It's actually fair to say the Christian's goals can be happiness and eternal life. Right? Those are our goals. Let's be honest. Those are our goals. You didn't get involved in Christianity just so you could suffer as a martyr. What's the purpose of suffering as a martyr? Why? Why do you do it? Why do you put up with being killed or having your money taken or whatever else? Why?
Demonstrate your love.
All the, yeah, and but for what purpose also?
For the reward.
For the reward. All martyrs know that they are, quote unquote, going to their reward. That was the reason that they held on to it. Okay, so if that is the goal, is that the right goal? Yes, science tells us that's the right goal. That's what cross-nation, cross-organization, cross-cultures and socioeconomic status, cross-war and peace boundaries, all of it tells you that. The longest-running socioeconomic happiness survey tells you the same thing. And so does Christianity. Christianity and science match in this case. Now the question is, if that's our pursuit, and if we agree, and maybe we're not done talking about this, that the rules of Christianity / Judaism are ones that are optimal to make you happy. So maybe we still need to justify that, that those are the ones that will make you happy. So their goal, they claim their goal is that, but do they actually do that? All right, let's look at that next time. And then here's the one that we really want to know, and this is the one that we'll get into some detail the following weeks. How do you use the science? And I promised you this last week. The same way that if your desire is, I want to be an Olympic athlete, I want to be an Olympic runner, that they, if you are willing to listen to the trainer and do what they have to say, they will turn you into, if not an Olympic class athlete, a pretty phenomenal runner, at a minimum. What's the difference between the person who pursues that and us? Would you all, like I asked last time, would you all want to be an Olympic athlete? We all generally go like, yeah, it'd be nice to be an Olympic athlete. Okay, fine, you want to put the work towards it. No, why not? You don't have the desire, the deep desire to do so. So isn't the question, the next step, if our goals are right, is how do we build the desire so that we can use the science? Because I think we can recognize just almost intuitively, if you've got the desire, if you're willing to do it, the science can turn you into a great runner, a great bicyclist, a great scholar, a great whatever else it is. Yes, I think so. How do you get the desire? And here's the teaser trailer, or a teaser point for you to think about a little bit. It will not be divorced from purpose. Your desire and your purpose will align perfectly, or God isn't good at making people. Right? Your purpose and your desire, properly done, will align perfectly, or God is not good at making people. I think God is very good at making people. And so when you look at somebody and you say, well, Scott's too short to be a center in basketball, so I'm not too short from his purpose for me. Or they look at this guy and say, he's too big. Oh, he's too big to be a runner. He's not too big to be whatever God has him to be. That kind of thing. So, purpose is going to be really, really key. All right, a couple of admin notes, and then I'll also send out the study stuff. We will stop class in about 2 minutes. A big class called Homefront comes in after us, and they break down the wall. And apparently, because they do load up a bunch of people out here, so maybe 100 people might be queued, not queued up, will be milling about. So, in a system of order whose goal is to increase the happiness of everybody else around us. If we can, we want to depart out that door so they can come in this door. Basic flow control stuff. So appreciate your help in that. We can actually go right up until 10:15, but I kind of have to mentally stop at 10:10 in order to do so.
It's Bhutan, not Nepal.
Bhutan, thank you. Good correction. Bhutan for the national global happiness, or domestic happiness. Product. That's it. Also, if you are Bhutan, you better pick something other than GDP.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of hard to do.
I've heard it said, and I don't know if it's true, that the happiest Christians on earth are the Mormons. But those people are just blissfully happy.
And the question is, does the science bear that out? And maybe as a group, some of it does. And remember, this is a good point. Dennis asked another really good point last time. I think these two are similar. Dennis's question was, if there is a set of behaviors, ideals, or whatever that is better than others, like if what Christians say is true, that there is a right way to do things, then you ought to be able to basically rank order denominations of Christianity. And some of them are better than others, and he's absolutely right. Now, you know what the sad thing is for Christianity? And I'm excluding the Mormons from Christianity in this case that I'm making right here. Say the Mormons are outside of Christianity because their beliefs do not match well enough the core beliefs of what it means to really be a Christian. Let's say that we have made that argument. We haven't made it, but let's just say that we've made it. If that's the case, what if the Mormons going back to my Ferrari analogy that you heard me give before of, you know, follow the recommendations for a Ferrari manufacturer and you'll be maximally happy. What if they're better at following the instruction book than the average person that calls himself a Christian? What if they follow the laws of God better? What about our Jewish brethren? We say, well, these gentlemen have missed the whole point. The whole point was the Messiah, and they're supposed to do this. Well, if they live the laws of God, and by the laws of God, I mean the ones that he created for this natural world, for things like this machine, better than we do, what would we expect to see from them?
So can a Muslim be a better Christian than you?
Absolutely. And that's what I ran into when I was a Marine about in Southwest Asia, was I found a Muslim who was a better man than I am, and it kind of messed up my worldview a little bit, and I had to say, or question made me question it, and say, what is it that makes him better than me? And what I found out was, God has a universal set of laws. You read this in Romans 1. He was a better man and more righteous than I was, where righteous is conformity, what Dennis was talking about, that kind of ideal, if it does exist. And I think that he was. And I think that there are Jews who are better Christians than Christians. And I think there are Mormons that are better Christians than Christians.
Are there atheists?
Now the question is, are there atheists that are better Christians than Christians? In fact, I've accused you of being one on a couple of occasions with your taking care of the poor, of doing good service to other people. You go to church more than most Christians do. We laugh about it a little bit, but isn't it true? Isn't one of the reasons that we like Dennis? Now we'll talk about Dennis for a second. The fact that deep down, we feel that Dennis doesn't have an evil heart. That there's something good in him that we like, and it's part of why we
no matter how hard he tries.
No matter how hard he tries to pretend that he's a bad guy, he's actually deep down
a good. And I'm driving a minicab in the parade for the Pope.
And I forgot to announce. His Holiness the Pope has actually included Dennis in his parade. His minicab will be part of that procession. So, now what I'm not saying is this. What I'm not saying is this. If you conform perfectly to the ideal of a Christian, then you will be saved. That's not the point of Christianity, is it? The whole point is, nobody does. So how do you make it to that next step and still be happy? The answer is, there's somebody who's figured that out for you. You accept that as a gift. You take him to... So you're going to have a bunch of gaps. You've done good stuff, but you've done bad stuff. Who's going to fill the gaps with the bad stuff? The Messiah fills the gaps with the bad stuff. That's the point of Christianity. And it's the reason, it's the final reason that I actually think, and this will be my last point as we close for today, in my last 60 seconds. My final reason, and I will expound on this later, that Christianity is the most superior religion in the world, is because not only does it match science, not only does it match desires, not only is it intuitively understandable, it's the only one that makes complete and total match to me, makes a complete and total match to what we all know about the human condition, is that we are all broken. Christianity says that's the case, and then Christianity turns around and offers a fix for it that no other religion does in the same way. All of them have a little bit version now, but Christianity says, can't be done, you're broken, I'll fix you, then you can run. Not run to be fixed. You're broken, get fixed, now you can run and do what you want to do. All right, we'll talk about it a little bit more next time.